I'm Molly. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I actually don't know who asked me to come here. I was on Reddit complaining about something, and someone was like, oh, you went to AR. You should come back and speak at the alumni meeting. And so I'm here, and if you're in the room, whoever asked me, don't tell anyone what my Reddit handle is, because I don't want anyone finding what I posted on Reddit. So, anonymity. So I'm Molly. I've been sober for 10 and a half years. I got sober at AR back when it was on Cameron Road. I think the ranch was the men's unit at that time. And the where these meetings took place were up at Cameron. So I'm from South Austin. I have parents who should have never been allowed to have children, basically. My childhood was filled with alcohol, coke, pills, borderline personality disorder. And I mean, it was bad. It was really bad. It was a lot of chronic childhood trauma, you know. But I was lucky enough to have a loving extended family. Oh, there's a clock. Okay. I was lucky enough to have a loving extended family. My dad's mom, my grandma, we called her Mimi. She was basically my mother, and her mother was basically my grandmother. And they're the people who taught me how to be anything but a disaster. Because I actually had to look around. My mom's been in and out of rehab for the past year, so I had to be like, is she here? Are you here, Mom? But she's not here, so we're good. So I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, spent a lot of time with my great-grandparents, but I did live with my mom. My parents got divorced when I was six, which was good because they were a nightmare. And things got even worse, if they even had the capacity to get worse. But they did get even worse after my mom split up with my dad. And, you know, severe poverty, food insecurity. We shared cans of tuna fish and, you know, boxes of stuffing, whatever she had. And she would, you know, get drunk, pass out. I, in my 5 years of life, would go find her wherever she was passed out, put her to bed, put myself to bed, go to school in the morning, rinse, repeat the next day. It was a nightmare. And my stepdad came along, and he was an alcoholic and he was an addict, but he was a lot more functional than she was. And things got a little better when he was around. At least I didn't have to take care of my mom anymore, so that was nice. But my mom, she's from Michigan, and I heard some voices in the back that sounded like they were from the Midwest, too. But so she's from Michigan, decided when I was about 10, she wanted to go back home and took me with her. I found out later a lot of the reason why we left is because my stepdad got caught with cocaine at work and got fired, and that was the catalyst that pushed us to Michigan. But went to Michigan, was split from everything I knew that was good, and it just got worse and worse and worse. Just the worst neighborhoods in Michigan that you can think of. I was fighting all the time. I was getting beat up a lot. We moved every year, sometimes twice a year. By the time I graduated high school, I lived in like maybe 17 different houses or something like that. But things were kind of stable when I was in high school because we lived in the same house for 4 years, which to me seemed like an eternity. And it was okay. You know, I made friends. Finally, things got stable. And my senior year, I went back. I still spent 4 or 5 months out of the year in Texas and Austin with my dad and my grandma. And my senior year, my dad told me he wasn't paying for me to come back anymore. And I was like, he doesn't want me anymore. You know, my dad at that point had gotten sober. He got married, had a bunch of kids, and I was the baggage. And coming to grips with that as a kid really sucked. And when I got home, I found out from my mom that about 2 weeks before I graduated high school, that her and my stepdad were taken off too. So they took off about 4 days after I graduated high school, and I was homeless for the first time. And I didn't have a license. My parents never helped me get a license. And I was in a rural area. We like landed in a very rural area of Michigan, very racist rural area of Michigan. And I was like real homeless with like all these real racist people. And I lived out of trash bags. You know, when you're homeless, people steal your shit. Sorry, I swear a lot. I know there's kids. I swear in front of my kid because I'm a terrible mother. But a lot of my stuff got stolen. Things got really bad, but, you know, there were no real signs that I was an addict from the beginning. I didn't really drink that much. My friends even got irritated with me that I didn't drink a lot. I would smoke weed on the weekends, but I wasn't the one supplying the weed, and I didn't really do hard drugs. My sister had a meth habit, and I saw what that did to people, and so I was really afraid of hard drugs, and I just didn't want to go there. And I had this like hope that like if I could get out of homelessness, you know, my whole life had been destroyed by my parents, that I thought, I can get out of homelessness, you know, I can get a job, I can get all these things, and then life can be okay, because then nobody will be controlling my life anymore. And things did get a little better for a little while. I had a girlfriend, her dad let me live with them, and then when he moved, my friend's parents let me live with them, and got a car. Eventually, my girlfriend helped me get my license, got a car, eventually moved to Lansing, Michigan, which is a terrible place, sorry, if you're from Lansing, Michigan, but moved to, it was a city, so there were jobs, and I got this job at Applebee's, and I made like $800 a month, which to me was like huge money in 2003, because I was like from super poverty, and still not using a lot then, thought I was doing okay. My girlfriend moved in with me, and we got this roommate, this woman we'd known for like 6 years that we thought was cool, and turns out, yeah, not cool, has antisocial personality disorder, was a monster, and we couldn't afford to make her leave. And so it was like I went from this borderline to this antisocial, and it was like that hope was gone, that hope that I could like take care of myself and that like things would be okay when I was away from my parents were gone, because I was like, the world just keeps throwing terrible shit at me, you know, and I can't control any of it. And, you know, this like monster is living in my house. I can't get rid of her. She's bringing all these men in, and I can't get rid of them because they're bigger than me. And they were constantly harassing me and my girlfriend. And we finally got her out. But by the time she was out, it was over. I was doing drugs all the time. I was so depressed. I fell into this horrible depression that was like, I felt like all I could see was in like grayscale. Like I felt like I couldn't see color anymore. And I knew I didn't want to do meth. I knew I didn't want to do heroin. I knew I didn't want to do crack, because my sister, just seeing what had happened with my sister, I was too afraid of it. So I thought like coke's fine. And so I did a lot of coke. And was really into hallucinogenics, really into ecstasy, basically anything that wasn't drinking. And I was actually a really functioning drug addict as far as functioning drug addicts go. I went to work when I had to go to work. I stayed sober when I had to go to work. I, you know, could do my hard drugs on the weekend, have my horrible come down, and then me do the things that you have to do during the week. And rock bottom for me began when my girlfriend and I broke up, because my girlfriend was an addict too, but she was a very stabilizing presence. And she was like the rock. She was like the least crazy drug addict that I had ever met at that point, you know? And so when we broke up, it was like my foundation left again. And I decided to move in with my mom and my stepdad because I make great decisions. And they lived on the other side of Michigan. They lived in Grand Rapids. And at that point, didn't have a car. My roommate stole it, so that was gone. And I didn't have access to my drugs or my dealers, so I started drinking. And I started drinking rum because that's what my stepdad drank. And, you know, I say there were no signs I was an addict in the beginning, but I do remember when I was a kid. I remember when I was like 7, maybe, and my dad had this like cinnamon gum, if y'all remember from like the 80s and 90s, and it was like in a little square pack, and it was like crazy spicy, and he went into this gas station, and I just like ate all of it. Like I didn't get like a piece. I like ate all of it like a creepy little rat in his car. And I remember like thinking like, this isn't normal. Like why can't I just have like a gum, you know? Why am I like devouring his gum like a creepo? And I had that thought again, probably the fourth habitual day that I drank in a row at my mom and my stepdad's house. I remember thinking, this is a problem. I can't not do this anymore. I can't like go through my hangover and just move on with my life. And I had like a real moment of clarity where I was like, this is going to be a serious problem. And when it does come to the point where I'm going to have to stop drinking, I know I'm not going to be able to stop. Because for me, drinking, it's funny, my dad's an alcoholic and he always said he didn't like drugs because it got in the way of his drinking, right? And I didn't like drinking because it got in the way of my drugs. But then when all that was left was drinking, then it was worse somehow. I don't know. And things got bad really fast. I was working at Red Lobster. which in Michigan is fine dining. And everybody was drinking every day, all day long. And I don't have a high tolerance for pain. And I realized pretty quickly, if I just drank a little bit in the morning, I wouldn't have to deal with the hangover. And so when I got sober, I would hear all these people tell these stories, and they'd be like, you know, I would work so I could drink, and I would work for the weekend, and I would be like, you stop drinking for a little while? Like, because I drank all the time. I got to the point where I would, like, hide flasks in my purse and drink at work, and I was, like, an inch away from losing my job because they caught me drinking on the job once. But because everybody was drunk there all the time, they, I guess, decided to keep me for some weird reason. And I was like, this is a nightmare. I was really aware that I couldn't stop, and I couldn't get out of my parents' house. And that was still filled with drugs, and, you know, I would come home from work, and my mom would be like, she would, like, take benzos and Ritalin, and they would, like, fight inside her body. And I would, like, come home to the result of the fight, you know, and it was, like, just a disaster living there. And I had, like, a really bad eating disorder. I was bulimic, so I was, like, functioning off nothing but rum for months. And so I looked awesome, as you might imagine. I looked like a nightmare. And I was like, I'm going to kill myself. I'm just going to kill myself because this is awful and it's never going to end. And suicide is, like, my family's business. My mom's dad committed suicide when she was young, when she was, like, 8. My mom's tried to commit suicide a bunch of times and would have if my dad hadn't caught, or my stepdad hadn't caught her. My grandpa's sister committed suicide. It's just what you do. And my cousin called it the curse. My cousin said, we're cursed. We live these horrible lives and then we die. It's like that mantra of, like, life sucks and then you die, but, like, taken to, like, the most extreme version that it could be. And I was like, yep, that's just it. And I was writing suicide notes, and my friend had just moved to Florida, my best friend, the one whose parents let me stay with them when I was homeless for the first time. And she was like a live-in caretaker for this really rich paraplegic that worked for NASA. And she was like, just, like, transfer your Red Lobster job down to Cocoa Beach, I think. I was so drunk. I don't even know. And so I was like, yeah, fuck it. Why not? And so I, like, transferred, flew down there, almost missed the flight because I couldn't stop drinking long enough. Had to get someone to take me to I actually don't even remember getting there. Got there and thought, I got to stop drinking. Like, this is too much. This can't go on anymore. And so I stopped drinking after a year and a half of drinking every day with an eating disorder. So just, like, a year and a half of my metabolism running off of just nothing but rum, which is so gross. You know, I would go to bars and people would be like, do you want me to make it cold? And I'd be like, no, like, just give me your well rum and give it to me warm. I don't care. What do you do? Like, most of the time it was just in my purse and I would just, like, go in the bathroom and drink. I would have people hold my purse. And they'd be like, why is this so heavy? And I'm like, because there is, like, booze in it. And I'm like, shut up before they catch us. Oh my God, it was a disaster. There was nothing classy about me. I mean, there still kind of isn't, but it was, like, really bad. And so my friend who I go to Florida to live with, this in-house, this, like, wealthy, renowned NASA man who's got all these plaques, and she was like, oh, she's cool, she's not weird, she'll only be here long enough to get her, you know, apartment. And my friend had been living away, we had been roommates for a while, but we had been living apart for so many months, she didn't know how bad I had gotten. And I was really good at pretending like I wasn't drunk. So nobody really knew how bad my problem was. And in fact, when I went to rehab, everybody was like, what? Like, they were shocked, kind of. And so I move in. And within, like, a few days, she realizes how insane I am. And she was like, we have to play Anne Frank. You have to hide in my bedroom, and you have to be really quiet, because I can't let this man know how crazy you are. And I was just like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. And I tried to go to work for the first time at Red Lobster, and I don't remember, because I was, like, drunk. I remember there were, like, there were tears, and then, like, I tried to walk back to the apartment and I got lost, and it was Florida, so there were signs that was, like, dangerous alligators, and I was like, I'm gonna die in the Florida Everglades or something. And So I was like, I have to stop drinking. This is ridiculous. So I stopped drinking. And I knew, like, in theory, that withdrawals were a thing. And like shakes and stuff. Like, I had gotten the shakes before and things like that. But I didn't know that when you withdraw off alcohol that you can die. And I didn't know that you can get something called auditory hallucinations. And I got them really bad. I, like, was laying on my friend's floor maybe the second day of being sober. And I thought I could hear what was, like, somebody vac, because they lived in an apartment, some, or like a really fancy condo, somebody vacuuming above me. And I thought, like, that's so rude. Like, who the fuck vacuums at 3 a.m? And it, like, morphed into this other thing. And then finally it morphed into, like, Satan. And it was, and I was freaking out, and I was, like, plugging my ears, because I was like, how am I hearing this? But I would, like, plug my ears, and I could still hear it, and I was like, please, please make this stop. And I heard, like, it'll stop if you promise gar, which is, like, by the way, I don't know what gar is, but it's, like, a running joke now with my friends. Gar, like, my friend, like, named her lizard gar, because it's just, like, this, I don't know, your brain does weird things when you're hallucinating. And so I heard, and I'm trying to hide it, like, I don't want her to know the extent of how insane I am. And so, and I'm hearing, I start hearing like this 20s jazz swing band comprised of demons telling me they're going to like kill my family if I tell anyone what's happening. And I'm like, I've that's it. I've gone crazy. I've gone completely insane. And I finally came clean, told my friend, we called my mom, or she called my mom. And my mom was like, no, you're just withdrawing. Like the same thing happened to your uncle. And I was like, oh, well, that's good to know, I suppose. And so start drinking, voices go away. And she's like, what do you want to do? And I'm like, you know, I don't know. I guess go to rehab because, like, what can I do at this point? So we call Mimi, my grandmother. Or she, I keep saying we, she. I was laying on the floor in a pile of probably pee. I don't know. And I woke up naked in a bathtub at one point. I do remember that. I think she was trying to give me a bath. I don't know. And she calls my grandmother, is like, Molly's withdrawing. She has to go to rehab. And my grandmother was like, that's nice, honey, but you have to call her father. I'm in the middle of a hurricane right now. Because this was in 2008. This is when Ike was hitting Houston. My grandmother lived in Houston. My grandmother ran emergency evac for hurricanes out of the Austin VA or the Houston VA system. And I knew that, but I was so self-involved that I'm thinking, call my grandmother. She can save me. Like, no, she's in the middle of the eye right now, trying not to die and trying to keep all of the Houston Galveston area safe. But that's how self-centered I was. And so we call my dad. She called my dad. And he says, okay, fly her here. So I fly to Texas. By then, I fly back to Texas. I weigh nothing. I have no underwear. I have no socks. I'm in like a really short skirt and a tube top. And I think flip-flops. And that's it. Like, basically, I was naked. And I show up weighing nothing, looking awful, essentially naked, and I'm just like, here I am. And my dad, who hasn't seen me in a couple of years, was just like, let's get you to rehab. And so, but he was like, let's stop off and like go to a meeting first. So we go to a meeting first, and there's this family that I grew up with when I was living in Texas. And one of the sons was kind of like my brother, but I hadn't seen him in like 10 years. And my dad's like, look who I brought. It's Charlie. And I was just like, why would you bring Charlie? I don't want to see Charlie right now. Like, I'm not wearing underwear. And so I'm sitting between my dad and Charlie, I think at Western Trails. And this woman like comes up to me and she's like worried about me and handed me a bracelet or something. Anyway, I go to Austin Recovery up on Cameron. And I'm like, my dad's basically like, good luck, and just walks away. And still no underwear, still no socks, still no nothing. And I remember getting there and having like a bag, like a small bag of what I hadn't lost on my like blackout journey through two states and finally into rehab. And the guy is like going through my bag to make sure I don't have paraphernalia in there, you know. And he like pulls out these like fishnet stockings and like looks at me with like question marks. And I was just like, I have no idea. I don't know why that's why I chose to bring that. I don't remember anything for at least 2 weeks now. So I get there and I get sober for the first time in like a year and a half. And I have like a complete nervous breakdown and I'm bulimic and they keep trying to give me my withdrawal meds after I eat. And I finally had to be like, I am going to die. You have to stop giving me these withdrawal meds after I eat because I can't control the impulse to not throw up. And they were like, okay. Like, you know, and so they would like leave apples for me at the desk. And I was like in really bad shape. They had to monitor me. My everything was just dying basically. And, but something started to shift while I was in recovery. And it was really small at first. But the first thing I recognized was everybody was exactly like me. I didn't have to hide who I was anymore. And all of these people were just like sitting out on the patio sharing stories about the things that they did and talking about things openly, and it felt like a Kevlar vest just came off. Like I could just talk to people and not have to hide the things that I'd done and what I was. And, you know, AR was like, can we do a case study on your eating disorder? Because we're pretty sure other women have eating disorders in here, but we don't know how to figure out who or to help them. And so I was like, yeah, whatever. So we started this like meeting, this eating disorder meeting. And I remember this woman in there was like, stop offering me a granola bar. I'm not going to eat the granola bar. I'm going to eat every granola bar in that box, and then I'm going to go throw it up. And I was like, yeah, right, yeah. And I was just like, exactly. Like, I'm so glad I don't have to hide this anymore, and I don't have to hide the drinking and everything else. And there were people in there that didn't seem totally freaked out by being in rehab. And I remember there was these women who like, because I don't know if it's like this now, but the way it used to be is it was just like the women's center. It was like a building with nothing but women in it. And then there was like a detox attached. And I remember there was these women who had like blankets and pillows that they had brought from home and like hair products and things like that. And I still didn't have socks or underwear, you know? And I thought like, oh, you're so fancy. And like, I don't know if it's the same now, but back then they wouldn't give you conditioner because it had alcohol in it. And I have really curly, frizzy, awful hair. And so I didn't have conditioner. My dad wouldn't drop anything off. And so I basically just like matted it into like some buns all over my head. And you know, and then there's these people with all this hair gel and like diffusers and stuff. And I was like scrounging through the clothes closet like a rat trying to like find some underwear, you know? And I was a disaster. And I found this like man's tuxedo jacket that I wore for like the first year of sobriety. And everyone's like, oh, you're like cool. And I was like, no, I just don't have anything. And, got out of AR, was homeless again. And, somebody in one of the counselors was nice enough to give me a 3-ring binder and was like, go find a sober house. And so I was just like, I'll go there. And, literally just picked a place. And so they had me show up to do kind of like an interview, I guess. And I showed up and it was my dad's old house from when I was in junior high. And I was like way weirded out, and they ended up accepting me. So my first bedroom in my first sober house was my little brother's old bedroom. Like our dog was buried in the backyard. And it was very weird. And my dad and my whole family showed up at one point to visit me there, and they were like, this is cool. And I'm like, oh, you should not bring children here anymore. And but the sober house had really strict rules. You had to be out by like, it was more like a shelter than a shelter you paid rent to. You had to be out by 7. You couldn't hang out there during the day, you know. So I spent my early sobriety at the NA North Austin Foundation, just hanging out there, hanging out at the Trinity Center, going through the clothes closet at the Trinity Center, getting food stamps, getting a bus pass, wandering around, trying not to get sucked back into drugs by other people on the street who were like, you look very homeless. You want to come drink with me? And I was like, no. And, you know, it sucked. But the mindset was different from the first time that I was homeless. I felt like I had hope, and I had a community that I could go to. I would literally sit in the North Austin Foundation and just watch the clock. Because I couldn't do one day at a time. I could do like 1 second at a time. And I would literally watch the clock and think like, I can stay sober for the next 5 minutes. And then the next 5 minutes would go, and I would say, okay, the next 5 minutes, the next 10 minutes. And they would sometimes come out and be like, honey, do you need a bed? Do you need somewhere to go? And I was just like, no, I just need to not leave because I'll probably get drunk if I do. Or high or whatever. It was bad too. Back then at AR, it was like on Cameron, and the exit was right by my door. So every night I was just like, I could just walk right out that door and just go find me an underpass and find some new friends. And oh God. But yeah, it got better. I had this dream like, oh, I'll get an apartment and I'll like be able to hang out in it when it's raining and take a nap. And I finally, you know, I bounced from sober house to sober house, and I finally did get an apartment was with an old friend I had from rehab. And as soon as I got the apartment, never got to take that nap because her boyfriend moved out and they both relapsed on heroin. And I had to beat the life back into them and then left. And I'll go get to some of those again. And I finally, you know, I stayed with some friends, and then I ended up moving in with my boyfriend who I just started seeing. And it was okay. You know, it was like, I knew everything would be okay because I had a community that I could be accountable to, that I could go back to, that I could be honest with. And the big thing for me was being honest. It wasn't hiding who I was and pretending that I was better than I was or more functional than I was. And, you know, my boyfriend and I, he was a recovering heroin addict. He, too, was homeless in South Padre, slept under boats. And so I started doing the step work. And the step work was really easy for me because, you know, step one was easy peasy lemon squeezy. You know what I mean? Like, you don't hallucinate Satan if you don't have a drinking problem. And so step two is pretty simple. I'm not religious, but I believed in God. Whatever. My life is terrible. So step three, I don't care if even one of the demons from that weird jazz band wants to take a crack at it, because I'm like not interested in controlling this anymore. And I was like, wanted that fourth step so bad. I was like, it was going to be my swan song. Like, I would write it. I tucked it into bed with me last night. I was like, yeah, I'm going to write everything all those people did to me, and I'm going to tell people, and they're going to like grip their pearls, and everyone's going to be horrified. And I was just like, oh, this fourth step. On to the fifth step. And my sponsor could not be more bored. She was like so bored by my life. And I was like, I think that was the next shift when I was like, yeah, my life is not that interesting. Lots of people are homeless. Lots of people have trauma. Lots of people have emotional abuse. Everyone I knew had an eating disorder, you know? So it was just like, yeah, I guess it's not that interesting, I guess. And then, so I don't know, there was like relief to that, like realizing that it wasn't as interesting as I thought it was. And then on to the fifth step. And she was like, well, you have your list right there from your fourth. And I was like, why don't you tell me how I'm supposed to make amends to my mother? And she was like, well, do you engage in her drama? And I'm like, yeah, because it's fun, but it's still not good. And I'm not the one causing it. And she was like, well, maybe you should stop doing that, you know? And I was like, whatever. And so, but, you know, so it was like quick shifts there, you know? And, you know, I realized, like, life isn't a curse. Yeah, life sucks sometimes. That's just the way it sucks. What the curse was not life. It was my response to it, you know? And I started living differently. Do I do this 10 more minutes? I meant to make a timer and I forgot. Okay. So I had a plan. I forgot to do it. So, I realized I could control the impulse I could find home groups that could help me not self-sabotage if I was honest enough. And it was the home group, which for me was Boldum, which I used to go to with my dad when I was a kid, when he got sober, and having a sponsor and having friends that I made, my litter mates, you know, people who had gotten sober around the same time as me, who understood what I was going through. Those were the people that kept me sober. I could not have gotten sober and stayed sober without the recovery community, without a sponsor, and without friends. it's not possible. My mom, like I said, is in and out of rehab all the time. She goes to rehab, goes to detox, gets out, and is like, I'm going to stay clean this time. And I'm like, no, you're not. Because you're not going to go to meetings afterwards. You're not going to make friends. You're going to go home. You're going to isolate. You're going to get drunk. And, you know, my mom's family, the family business is suicide. My dad's family, the family business is alcoholism and dying from it. A lot of people in my family have gotten sober, but the ones that didn't died. My dad's dad died at 42 from alcohol-related diseases. His brother died at 52, and their cousin died at like 48 or something. You die. And, you know, my uncle, I mean, it's the same story. All of us were very close to them. He was from Austin. He wouldn't find a community. And it's impossible to do it without that. And that's what I finally had that I hadn't had my whole life that I was like so desperate for. And a higher power for me, you know, I'm not religious. I was raised, my dad was very oppressively religious. So that is not something that appeals to me. But, you know, sometimes for me, my higher power was just I-35 when I was trying to get to work. And it was like, drop still, like no one's moving traffic. And it was like, I can't control this. Like, this is just, I just have to accept this. I should have left earlier. I didn't. I never do. So I'm going to be late again. I'm going to get in trouble. It's just accepting life on life's terms for me and giving up and being able to accept that. I went back to college and I always wanted to be an interior designer growing up, but I never thought I'd actually do it because interior design, it's actually really hard. It's a STEM field. So you have to use a lot of technology, CAD, Revit, BIM modeling, trigonometry, engineering, hard things. And so it's like one of those things that you want to do, you know, like you want to be a doctor, but you're never going to go to med school, you know. But I went to school, went to community college, and actually graduated. I have a bachelor's of science in interior design now. And I graduated top of my class from the best program in Texas. It's the top 20 in the nation. And I did that because I had a community who supported me because I didn't stop being a disaster once I got sober. I was a disaster the entire time I was in college. I would have nervous breakdowns every time I started a class. And I'd be like, I can't do this. And people would be like, well, you do this every single class, and then you always get A's. And even if you fail, like, you're not homeless right now. So who, like, why is this something you're concerned about right now? And when I was in school, I've always been involved in politics. Got a job at the Texas legislature. I've worked in the Texas legislature when it's in session for the past 6 years. I'm an interior designer. I'm an artist. I have my own business. I'm a policy analyst. I run an internship, teaching people how to, it's nonpartisan, teach people how to analyze public policy, how to write public policy, and how to testify. Which is funny, I told Chris actually that this wouldn't be hard because I speak publicly for a living, but like I don't usually tell people how awful I have been. So this is a little harder. I don't usually tell people I spent almost an entire year naked at the Capitol. Maybe I should. I don't know. And so the first time in my life, I was like accomplishing things, you know? And, you know, I wasn't just coping anymore. And I had the energy to go out and try new things. I wasn't exhausted all the time, emotionally and physically from all the drugs. And I suddenly became one of those people that I would look at when I was using and was like, man, I wish I could be like them. They seem normal. And like, to be clear, I'm not normal. I'll never be normal. Like, I did at one point think that I'd get sober and then I would be not crazy. You're never not crazy. You're like always crazy for the rest of your life. But like, I was functioning and at a really high level. And I stopped going to meetings at about 5 years sober. And it was because some people in my home group did some things and I thought they were rude to me and I didn't need to do this and this is wasting my time anyway. And so I stopped going and I stayed sober and I coasted for a really long time. A lot of people say you can't stay sober outside of the rooms. I could after a long, I don't think you can in early sobriety, but I could with a fair amount of sobriety, but I immediately started falling back into self-loathing and self-doubt and judgment. I was so judgmental of everyone. I didn't have compassion for people anymore. And then life happened. You can coast as long as life is smooth. I had my son at 7 years sober. 2 months after I had my son, my cat died, which sounds dumb, but I loved this cat. Like, loved this cat. My husband always said we had, like, an unhealthy relationship, her and I. Like, she would sleep with me in my bed, and we would spoon. Like, when I had my son, they didn't have any beds at the hospital, so they sent me home to labor until I almost had to push, and she was, like, my doula, you know? Like, she was, like rubbing my face. And the cat was awesome. And she just fucking died. Like, she had cancer, and we just didn't know it. And I felt so guilty because I didn't. How do you not notice something that you care about is sick? And it was because I was, like, so self-involved. I couldn't even see things as obvious as that. And then at 3 months after my son was born, my grandmother was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer. And ovarian cancer is not really treatable, not when it's advanced. And at 8 months, the treatment stopped working. And I was one of her caretakers. And my grandma was supposed to be in my son's life. And I'll never get over it, and I'll never be okay with the fact that he will never know who she is. But because I was at least sober, I could be there and be her caretaker. And when she died, my cousin who was very close with her, who happened to be a funeral director, were able to plan her funeral. I was able to design her headstone. I was able to deliver the eulogy. We were able to lay her to rest. I could not have done any of that if I hadn't been sober. And after she died, my life collapsed. And it was like it was right before I got sober. And I kept telling my husband, like, I feel like I did right before I got sober, but I didn't do anything. I didn't relapse. I didn't do anything to feel like this, but I did. I had stopped going to meetings. I had stopped trying to develop emotionally and spiritually. I'd cut myself off from the communities that had helped me when I'd gone through bad things before. I couldn't hold a job. I started lying. Suicidal ideation came back really strong. I had plans. I told my husband I'm probably going to kill myself. I was very afraid of being around myself and told him, if I kill myself, please don't tell our son that I did that, because knowing that everyone in my family did that growing up, it was always an easy way out, and I didn't want that to be the case for him. And I almost checked myself into Austin Oaks, and my friend said, you should call your sponsor. And I was like, well, I haven't talked to her in like 5 years. I don't think she's technically my sponsor anymore. And she's like, yeah, but you should try. And so I called her, and I was like, do you remember who I am? And she was like, oh, yeah, so, hey. And it was like she was still my sponsor. And I think part of the reason why I didn't go back was because I was afraid of people, how they would respond. I thought when I would go back, people would be like, see, I told you. I told you it wouldn't work. I thought people would judge me, and that's not what happened. And she was like, you should go to a meeting, like, right now. Like, you should get off the phone and go to the meeting. And I did, and I went back into AA full force, and, you know, within months, the suicidal ideation lifted, which sounds kind of horrible because months is a long time, but I was pretty low at that point. And the fear lifted, the isolation lifted, and I realized I can't do this without the recovery community. You know, I can stay sober, but I won't survive. I'll kill myself. Because after you're sober for so long, it becomes habitual. You know, you could just do the habit thing of not using, but emotionally and spiritually, you're going to regress regardless if you're sober or not. And I'm not as high functioning as I was before I had my son, but what I am is content. Recovery has gifted me acceptance in replace of my resistance, and it's given me growth instead of coping, and contentment instead of oblivion, because that's like the end goal when you're using, is just to run away from your emotions. And now I actively try to engage with them. I remember when my grandma died, I couldn't deal with it emotionally. And when my sponsor was like, you need to start dealing with it, the only way that I could do it was watch Moana. You know that part where the grandma died? And just cry hysterically. And I would just do that every couple of days, because it was like the only way that I could handle it and start going through the motions of grieving. And I remember sitting in Austin Recovery in a room, like in the meetings you do during the day. And I was with about 25 women. And this person said, of you 25, 30 women, however many there were, only 4 of you will get sober and stay sober. And I remember thinking, like, one, that's kind of a crappy thing to say to a bunch of drunks. And two, like, I wonder who these four women will be, because I had no faith it would be me. And I remember looking around being like, maybe it's this person over here or that. And all I had was a desire to change and in the recovery community. And that 5 seconds at a time at the North Austin Foundation. And you don't have to do this alone, because you can't do this alone. I hit the place that many of you are at right now after two bouts of homelessness, basically naked and dying. I literally smelled like shit, by the way. I think I'd stepped in something or that. You ever been like so homeless that you smell bad? You know you smell bad, but you don't really know where the smell is coming from. Like, I was that person, and I was in the car with my dad, and I could tell he knew I smelled bad. And like, I was just like waiting to get away from him because I didn't even know where to begin to locate that smell. If recovery can help me go from that to what I am now, it can help anyone. I know it can help anyone, because I was way gross, like way gross. And I read this thing on Reddit, and it said, be the adult you wish you had when you were a kid. And that meant a lot to me, and I saved it. And now I can be that adult that I needed when I was a kid. I can be that adult for my son, and I can be it for other kids when I'm in the activist community. And I know all of y'all can get to whatever little goals you have as long as you're in the recovery community. And thank you.